Hey, welcome to the Bean House. Jeff here.
And Chris here. I'm back. I'm happy. I'm in my tie-dye. It's a good day.
I'm in earth tones. So that's about par for the course for me. So
I have 29 favorite colors. I like wearing them all at once.
For those of you not here, basically all of you, I just shook my head really hard and realized like you couldn't see that. So
yeah,
we're back, having a great day, getting ready to try some mead. First off, of course, we want to thank our audience, listeners. You guys keep reaching out, keep giving us that feedback that you're listening, you're using the information we're talking about, you're enjoying.
And we appreciate every bit of it.
It's really gratifying to hear that feedback. You know, keep it coming. And hey, again, let us know what you want to hear about. Is there a topic you're itching to hear discussed? Do you want to take a deep dive on this side or the other? Did you listen to one of our topics and realize we missed a major point that you need further information on?
Speak up. We're glad to go back.
Find us at the website, www.themeadhouse.com, or at our Facebook, The
Meadhouse.
Reach out any which way. And yeah,
let's make sure you got the information you want.
Yeah.
So, and also I'm going to thank our sponsor, Bacchus and Barleycorn.
Absolutely.
Fantastic group of guys. Jake and his team there, Jake, Ryan, all really friendly, very good about helping you with information, getting you the stuff you need. And if you use our promo code,
yes,
MHP10. Yes, I got it right this time.
You got it right
this time. It took me 3 weeks, but I got it right this time. But MHP10, and you can get 10% off your order, your online order, or, you know, and tell them, if you ever stop and visit them, tell them you heard about them from us. You know, we would appreciate that, and he would too, because he has been very generous, and we'd like to pay it back.
Absolutely. No, whether you need the information, the ingredients, the equipment, they got it for you. Reach out. You can find a link in our show notes along with that promo code, MHP10. Get yourself a little discount getting the stuff you need.
And now, the meat of the day is something that we've had on the back burner for a little bit, and I'm looking forward to. Mm-hmm. This is a Honeybrook Huckleberry Mead.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I haven't heard of Honeybrook. Is that the right way to say that?
Honeybrook, I think, yeah. Do we know where they are made in? Honeybrook Craft Meadery in Castle Rock, Colorado. So not too far from here, actually.
No, actually, reasonably close.
In the grand scheme of things.
Well, yeah, we're Midwesterners. Anything under 6 hours, after 6 hours, we'll say, oh, okay, that's a bit of a drive.
I mean, it's a little bit of a drive then, because I don't know where Castle Rock is in Colorado. But
neither do I, but it's only a state away.
8 hours of Kansas, and, you know, we're fine.
Yeah, right? Cool, yeah. Fine.
Anyway, let's pop this guy open, because this is directly related to our topic for the day. This is labeled as a draft meat today. We're going to talk about sparkling.
Okay, here we go.
Let's pour a couple glasses here.
Love the color.
Yeah, this is a pretty little blush color. Obviously, it's carbonated. Got a little
fizziness on top.
Right, little lacing of carbonation on the glass. The funny thing about mead as opposed to beer is that with beer, you get like that head, that persistent
foaming.
Right, and that sticks around for a while. You don't get that on mead generally, because part of the reason you get that in beer is the protein content from the grains. You just don't get the same level of protein from honey and fruit and stuff like that. So usually the
fizziness goes away.
Right. You get a little persistent kind of a white ring around the outside edge of your glass, but that's about it.
So yeah, like I say, it's a nice red color, a light red color. I mean, more like burgundy.
I wouldn't say it's even burgundy, but it's a kind of a rosy blush color. Not super dark. You know, I'm swirling it, even though it's a sparkling mead, so it's gonna just throw a bunch of bubbles instead of cheating the glass or having legs.
Yeah, well, it's a habit you have as a judge. I don't have such things.
Take a little sniff here.
Oh, I like that.
Oh, that's a very berry forward.
That's really nice berry forward there.
A little bit of honey on the back end, but yeah, no,
that's enough berry for it. I didn't catch the honey on the first round, and even the second round. I like that berry.
And this is huckleberry, right?
Huckleberry.
I can't remember the last time I had something with huckleberry or like whole huckleberries.
Yeah. No, me either. Oh man. Oh, here we go though.
Yeah, let's.
Oh, that's nice.
That is nice.
That is nice. This is a light semi-sweet.
Mm-hmm.
It's not hard. It's verging on the edge of the bottom end of semi-sweet.
It's kind of like a, I would say, off-dry.
But yeah, off-dry.
Off-dry like to semi-sweet, yeah.
But I like the berry flavor, and that's right there.
Berry flavor is nice. It's a little, so for a lot of these, I'm not calling it a wild berry because it's not wild, but it's not like highly domesticated and farmed like a blackberry or a blueberry. I'm assuming they have like patches that they've encouraged to grow kind of thing to get enough huckleberry to make a huckleberry mead. You tend to get a little bit more acidity in these, and I'm feeling that here. It has a little bit of an acid bite, which is nice.
The tannin is very subdued here. I'm not getting, I mean, it's there,
It's there.
but it's not forward.
I disagree a little bit. It is pronounced. It's not out of balance.
Okay, I'll buy that one.
Yeah, it's there. And for a mead this light to have this much tannin, it would be easy to throw it out of balance. But I think it's there
They did
and
well.
it's doing nice. Yeah, this is a light, easygoing mead. It's not highly carbonated. I think it's
There's
probably.
no bubbles to be seen in my glass here, but I can feel a little bit when I drink it.
Right, you feel it on the tongue. Right, we're not getting like a fountain head of bubbles coming up from the bottom like you get with some kind of like, especially like a champagne,
Like
like you
champagne
think.
or even sodas.
Right, those are more heavily carbonated, shall we say. This, I think, is, I wouldn't say it's petalant. We talked about that a few episodes back, where it's not quite carbonated. I think this is still a carbonated mead,
It's definitely
but.
carbonate. I mean, Petalant is so lightly carbonated you could miss it. You can't not miss this. This is here.
Not necessarily. I think Petalint has some carbonation. I might even say after letting this sit for a minute that it's kind of on that borderline between Petalint and carbonated.
Okay.
But I think it. I would call this carbonated.
Well, you have a
We're
little more experience with that than I do.
at this point. We're splitting hairs, though.
Very enjoyable meat. I'm really enjoying the huckleberry flavor. And I don't remember the last time I had huckleberry at all, like Jeff, but this is good.
Yeah, this is a very nice mead, and it's. The fruit flavors there's acid, there's tannin, there's like the three building blocks of a good flavor balance are right there. The berry flavor itself is very forward, it's very out there, and it tastes sweet, but not like cloyingly so. I think, yeah, this is just a really nice balance. It's very light body and like presentation too, which as we'll talk about when we get to sparkling meads, that's kind of an important thing.
But yeah, I mean, I would drink this for absolutely any reason. Dinner, coming home from work, coming in from this is just good.
Yeah, this is it's light, it's chill, it's easy. I mean, if it's light, it's easy going. The thing that I would say is like if I just wanted to get trash real fast, probably not the best one. I
No, but this is only a 6.2%.
that doesn't surprise me at all.
No,
It's
it's very light.
light, it's easy going. But as far as like, you know, having a drink with a buddy or some grilled food on a summer evening, or just, you know, chilling and watching the latest episode of whatever TV show my wife and I are enjoying at the time.
This is a definite, anytime meet.
Yeah, this is an easy going, easy, nice, fun thing. And I like sparkling for that. The other thing that I think personally, between you and me,
And everybody listening.
between you and me,
Okay.
everybody listening is just fly on the wall. They
Okay,
seem to
fine.
be, give my hot takes here.
Okay.
I get a little bit annoyed with the amount of space that the seltzer is progressively stealing when I go to a liquor store. It's taking more and more of the beer aisle away from beer to this light, low calorie, still alcoholic, but kind of piddly drink that is so freaking popular these days. And I don't understand why, because it's like those flavored carbonated waters they have in the you know, I don't want to name any names because that puts us in lane line for, you know, defamation lawsuits, but they call it grapefruit flavor, but it's, you know, this was sat next to a grapefruit on a train somewhere and the grapefruit rotted into the air.
Let me put in what a friend of mine told me. She calls it television static water. It tastes like television static, and it's like somebody's whispering from the next room what the flavor is.
That's about right.
Okay.
So
Thank you, Bexy.
my thinking is, yeah, you might end up with a little bit more caloric drink by doing a light mead, like I've been advocating for an age and a day. But if you make a 5 to 6% ABV dry mead with some nice fruit or spice flavor to it, or hops would be great for this too. I know not for you, but
But you
for most
know,
people,
most people like that, and I have no problem with them enjoying what they enjoy.
you're gonna get a light, very drinkable, very flavorful and enjoyable thing. And carbonating it, like we're about to talk about, it's a win. And it's so much better than this fizz crap.
Now, in my defense, I like salt sparkling waters, flavored waters, But there, most of them I don't. There's a very limited number of them I'll even entertain.
To be
But
fair,
they actually have flavor.
I like the mineral waters, the fancy like Perrier and things like that, especially the ones with like a citrusy flavor to them. It's like I am the same pretentious jerk that will request a little lime wedge or lemon wedge with my water when I go to a restaurant. Sorry.
Guilty right here. Okay, anyway, so we're talking about sparkling meads then. So we talked about that last time at the end, and I've only done one sparkling mead attempt in my life, and I will classify it as my first failure. Not because of the sparkling, because of the flavor, because I paid too much attention to try and make it sparkling and not enough attention to the base that it came from.
Okay, so I'm going to make a guess here
Okay.
for our audience, and I'm going to guess that when you did your sparkling, you bottled it and you used some of the little carbonation tablets or caps and things from Walker's
Absolutely correct.
Cloud.
Absolutely correct.
Yeah, that's the for the first attempt at carbonating something, that's kind of like, hey, I went to the homebrew store and I saw these things. I bet I could do that.
Yeah,
Yep.
that. I mean, this is my first year of brewing.
And you're not alone here. This is why I'm guessing that, because
Yeah.
that's kind of everybody's thought. I bet I could do that. There are some things you need to understand.
Yeah, and I it was didn't come out well. In fact, it was so bad we let it was lost in our in a closet in my house for almost 2 years after that. When I popped one open 2 years after, it was still carbonated, mind you, and it was slightly better in taste, but I still poured every bit of it out.
So this is a little bit of a unique standpoint, though. The carbonation part worked, the flavor didn't.
No, it did not work at all.
I've talked to a lot more people that said, yeah, I put the carbonation caps in there, but nothing really happened. Or it got a little fizzy, but not a lot. And I didn't really like it afterwards. And
So let's qualify this. I put them in old glass Coke bottles, like the Mexican Coke you get. So like 12-ounce bottles
Right.
with half a tablet in them. A little high. A
Little low.
little low, really.
Those tablets are dosed to be to dose a 12-ounce or sorry, a 12-ounce beer bottle.
Okay, well, I'm surprised. I thought half would have done the trick, so that's what I did. And they were still carbonated. They weren't overly carbonated. They didn't pop and fizz when I opened them, but.
So, ladies and gentlemen, the topic we are talking about here, as far as conditioning in a bottle or carbonating in a bottle, in this regard, the term for this is bottle conditioning. And there are a number of like established, long centuries running beer companies, especially in like Belgium and Germany, that continue to carbonate this way. It's literally bottle conditioned. The yeast are alive when they put it in the bottle and eats the sugar, and you get carbonation as a byproduct.
And the carbonation has nowhere to go because you've capped. Now, mind you don't cork these. You cap them. You bottle cap these things because you do not want the risk of a cork. I personally have watched too much Tom and Jerry, so I capped mine. And that's probably why you should too.
Let's qualify this. Bottle bombs are a thing. For one, use bottle caps, like my buddy Chris here says. Use bottles that are designed to hold carbonation pressure. Most of the beer bottles you get at your homebrew store, fine. They're great for that. They're designed for that purpose because most everybody drinks carbonated beer, right? If you grab glass bottles from wherever, like IKEA has little flip-top bottles,
No.
those are not pressure rated. I
Mm-mm.
don't believe.
They're not.
Do not recommend it.
If it's a self-sealing bottle, I don't recommend it.
They have self-sealing bottles at your homebrew store. You can get. They're kind of pricey. That's what I got for the first like gallon batch of beer that I made in a Mr. Beer
Okay, cool.
when I was in college and decided that I needed to start brewing stuff.
Okay, I did not realize they could be, they were rated. The ones I've found so far have been.
Right. The IKEA ones are a cheaper animal that is not manufactured to hold pressure. The ones that you have at the homebrew store are designed to hold beer. So,
Okay, there you go.
yeah. But you need to understand a few different factors here. One, cap it. Two, make sure that your glass can hold pressure. Three, understand the pressure that you're putting into this product. The carb caps are nice because that is a pre-measured amount of sugar, and so you're not overdoing it. The other way to do it, the common way to carbonate, is using dextrose, which is just corn sugar, right?
Okay.
And for the longest time, when I was working at Bock's and Barleycorn, the kits that we sell were for 5 gallons of beer. And we had a little packet about, 2 by 3 inches of dextrose, which is just pre-measured for a 5 gallon batch of beer. So when you get to right before bottling, you rack it clean into a clean container, mix in your priming sugar, and then immediately bottle with the live yeast in there and let it sit.
There you go.
If you overdo it on the yeast, even if you have a bottle cap and a pressure rated bottle, you're still risking bottle bombs because you can exceed that pressure rating.
Okay, I'm going to bring up a story you told me a while back. You once upon a time capped a sparkling mead with the thought of pasteurizing it,
mm-hmm.
but you didn't.
Yep.
And it over a course of a few days, it blew up. I mean, it was a glass grenade that embedded glass into an onion on a counter nearby.
Right. The onion was sitting right next to it, stuck into it like a pincushion.
These can be dangerous. Be careful.
Had I been cooking at the time that went off, I would probably be scarred
yeah.
for life. My probably like 5 or 6 year old at the time son and wife were luckily sleeping at the time that went off. And holy shit, I'm glad they were, because they're into the house.
Now, mind you, this is an extreme example. This kind of thing can happen of any size bottle you use, mm-hmm. whether it be a 6 gallon carboy or a 12 ounce beer bottle. Mind you, I had a bottle bomb happen to me when I was at not this last rock run, but the year before, my first one, but it wasn't a bottle bomb.
It was a gusher, not a bottle.
It was a gusher.
Yeah.
Now I count it as a bottle bomb because the pressure. There's, it. I got an inadvertent taste of the meat. It was a lemon meat. It was lovely, but I popped the cap off so I could serve it to the judges, and I got showered with lemon meat. And that's a geyser. It's a gusher, not a bomb. By the same token, it was labeled as a still.
Right.
That is one of the milder things that can happen, and that bottle had less than a quarter of the bottle left after the geyser was done. So.
That's the nature of the beast here. So mm-hmm. the thing about using traditional bottle conditioning methods when making a sparkling mead is that there are some limitations here. Basically, the first thing you need to do is listen to our previous advice and ferment dry. Find out, basically do the calculations in your head to say, hey, I want an 8% mead and I want it sparkling. So how much honey do I need to make 8%? Cool. Put that in there. And only that amount. The unfortunate part is if you're going to do bottle carbonation, you don't really get much residual sugar safely. Otherwise, it's that sugar gets eaten up. There are some, I've heard some ways to meddle with that, and I'll talk about that here in a minute. But for the most part, we're talking about making a dry mead, adding a little bit of sugar for carbonation, and ending with a dry carbonated mead in a bottle.
That is the easier way, as I understand, to approach this. Because you're controlling sugar from a dry meat.
It's the less expensive way to do it, for sure. And requires minimal equipment other than, you know, bottles or capper and the stuff that you're already doing, using to make meat. Pretty much most of the way there. As far as getting some sweetness, I've heard a few cheats. You know, people will use things like a non-fermentable sugar. The non-fermentable sugar you can find at your homebrew store is lactose. That's not going to make it sweet unless you use a lot. It's not going to make it necessarily good. I know some people have used things like xylitol or monk fruit, things like that.
Monk fruit, I've heard.
Yeah, you can get those at like Costco or Sam Club or whatever in pretty big packs. I thought about trying that at one point, but I decided against it because apparently the xylitol can cause issues with people with rhythm issues with their hearts.
Oh, well,
like me.
Like you.
So it's kind of a, I'm not going to enjoy this if I'm going to go back to the hospital.
But
that's an approach that kind of can go through this drawback for some people, because there are people like my buddy Chris here that don't necessarily like dry stuff and would rather have sweet.
I'd rather have sweet, and because I'd rather have sweet, I'd really rather not worry about sparkling. Now, mind you, I am sitting here enjoying a lovely sparkling huckleberry mead.
Mm-hmm.
I have no problem with huckleberry mead. And this is actually a sweeter mead.
Yeah, it's medium sweet, I would
say. It's a medium sweet, and it's
trying to medium sweet.
So, you know, it can be done.
There are other ways to do this, and so let's talk about that.
Yeah.
From a homebrew perspective, the way you want to do this, you're basically kegging. To start, take your finished mead, stabilize it, for one, the same way we've been telling you to do since we got this thing back on its
feet. Yeah, track.
Right. Potassium metabisulfite, potassium sorbate, use package directions per however many gallons you're doing. Get that mead stabilized, then you can back sweeten to whatever flavor you like. Then, instead of putting it in bottles, put it in a keg first. Take the temperature down as close to freezing as you can without actually freezing it. Why?
I have no idea.
Because carbonation, for whatever reason, carbon dioxide dissolves easier in a liquid at colder temperature.
I did not know that.
Yeah. The other thing we need to talk about here with this is whether you're doing bottle conditioning or mechanically conditioning, shall we say, with a keg. The higher alcohol content of a product you're putting in there, the harder time you're going to have carbonating it, and the less carbonation is going to hang out.
So lower alcohol levels are better.
Right. So there is a reason a lot of the beer that you guys find at your local liquor stores and things like that are in the 3.5 to 5% range. If you get into the higher ABVs, like even as far as like 8%, like this guy loses
The
Acer
6.2.
6.2. When you get into the higher ABV range, it has a harder time holding onto that carbonation because it's alcohol, not water. Realistically, I think 8% is about the highest I would try getting a good level of carbonation on. But I like things when I'm drinking something carbonated. I want it to be carbonated.
You want a lot of carbonation.
I
You want
want it
it to clear your
bubbly.
nose.
I want it either still or bubbly. I don't want this halfway.
Okay, fair.
That's a me preference. That's not an everybody preference. But I want things to have carbonation. So anyway, we were talking about essentially the mechanical way to do it, or
So you
the
put in a keg,
you put it in a keg,
and then what?
you get it cold, close to freezing, and then you put it under pressure. And there are different schools of thought as to how to do this, as far as like how fast to do it.
How many ways do you know off the top of your head of how many ways to do that?
This is a gradients thing. So there are some people that like to do it fast, and they'll put it at 25 to 30 PSI
That's impressive.
under CO2 and shake the living bejesus out of it for a couple days, whenever they think about
You get a paint shaker? Well, how do you keep shaking? You just keep shaking it every once in a while. What?
You pick it up, shake it. I know some people will actually like, some people swear to me that they have put it on its side on a carpeted floor and then turned on, whatever TV show they like for an hour and just use their feet to knock it back and forth. But the point is, they agitate it at a very high pressure, and that'll apparently get it carbonated in a couple days.
That's new for me.
I usually put it in a high pressure and kind of let it sit. I'll shake it once in a while, but I got stuff I'm doing. I'm moving and grooving. I don't have time to come back and babysit, so I don't anticipate it getting carbonated as quickly. But I'll let it sit under a higher pressure like that for probably 4 or 5 days, and then kind of try and dial the pressure back and see where I'm at. There are some people that will do like, they intend to serve it at 5 PSI, so they will pump in 10 PSI and hold it at 10 PSI for a few weeks to reach their carbonation temperature. This is very much a personal preference thing. I would say, start at the 25 to 30 PSI and kind of dial it in based on what works for you. Here's the thing. This is a lot more expensive though than bottle conditioning, because now we're talking about buying a keg. And generally speaking, the 5 gallon kegs that you can buy in this country are left over from,
Beer.
no,
Really?
no, soda pop.
Oh, yeah, those.
Because now when you go to like a restaurant and you have like the fountain drink things, those are all like syrups that are connected from a single box, and they all have a single like a seltzer water line. It used to be
In metal cans.
right in 5 gallon kegs. That's why so many of these are printed either Pepsi or Coca-Cola. The fact is, it's a lot cheaper to ship syrup than it is to ship whole mixed soda. So they've moved away from the kegs.
Into boxes and
Right.
bags.
And home brewers found these and said, okay, well, why not? There are people that making 5 gallon kegs, either the ball lock or the pin lock. One was a Coca-Cola thing, one was a Pepsi thing, that are not related to either Coca-Cola or Pepsi now, because there is such an industry for these. But for the longest time, these are a byproduct of another industry that people just had a use for because no one else was using them for that. Which is not to say that, Coca-Cola and Pepsi don't do that. I've seen them still using those for reasons, but like, yeah, the anyway, you need to get a keg. You need to usually get a CO2 regulator to control the amount of CO2 coming out of your CO2 tank, which is the third thing you need. There's the little fittings and controls for your keg and this and that.
And you have to get a gauge to know how much you put into the...
That's part of your regulator.
Okay.
Generally. Your regulator should have an in and out level to tell you how much pressure is coming, is inside that tank of the CO2 and how much is going through the line.
Okay.
Essentially.
Well, again, I haven't done this, so this is right. All education for me.
This is, and I couldn't tell you the last time I priced half of this stuff out. CO2 tank, obviously, that is something that contains a limited amount of space. You will run out of CO2 as you're doing this. Generally speaking, I think if I remember right, I got 3 or 4 kegs worth of carbonation from a 5-pound CO2 tank, which is a tank that contains 5 pounds of CO2. It is not 5 pounds weight itself,
okay,
for the record. And then you got to refill. Your tank has a certification from the government as to when it was last inspected. It has to be reinspected every 5 years, and that costs money to have it reinspected. Usually, your homebrew store, you will, as long as the tank that you're trading out is within like 6 months of its inspection time, there's no additional cost for it. You just go in with your old tank, you get a new tank that's already been filled up for you. You don't have to go through the trouble of it. It's cheaper to find a place that will refill as you wait and, you know, just keep using the same tank. But generally, it's kind of a pain in the butt to find that place.
So basically, this is a lot of work. This is a lot of hassle.
There can be a lot of hassle. It's a lot more moving parts. And we haven't even talked about getting it bottled once you've got it carbonated yet. Because that's another thing. So you get it into a keg. You get it carbonated by letting it sit under pressure, whether it's a little pressure for a long time or a lot of pressure for a little less time.
Okay.
Now we need to get it out of that keg. There's two ways to do that.
But obviously, you can't open that up, or you're going to lose your carbonation.
Well, you'll start to lose your carbonation for sure. You can get a tap and just serve it from a keg. Like if you've got a kegerator, keyser kind of thing set up at home. That's a great way to do it. Everybody loves that.
Yeah. It's awesome for parties.
What if you want to take a bottle to your buddy?
It's a little different.
Yeah, you could.
You could do it directly in the bottle, couldn't you?
You could put the bottle like right under the tap and fill it. You'd lose some of the carbonation just from the agitation of pouring into the bottle and it kind of sloshing around. It'd still be a little carbonated, maybe, depending on how carbonated you got it. The other nice part about carbonating in a keg is that you can kind of fine-tune your level of carbonation, too.
Okay.
If you say, hey, I'd like this to be a little bit more carbonated, put more pressure on it. I'd like this to be a little less carbonated, bleed out some pressure.
Okay. So let's say I want a bottle.
Mm-hmm.
From my keg to a bottle, losing minimal carbonation.
Then you need another fancy device called a counter-pressure beer filler.
Okay.
And there are a bunch of these different guys on the markets, some of them more homemade than others. The one that I have, the one that I've used and liked for a while now, was actually made by the Blickman Company, the Blickman Beer Gun.
Okay.
They sent me one. I reviewed it, played with it a little bit.
This is new to me.
Yeah, it works. What this is, it's kind of like, on the one hand, you know, the bottle wand kind of things.
Yeah, I use that to fill my own bottles, yeah.
Right. They have a connection to whatever the source of your meat is, this time the carbonated meat. So obviously this connects to the keg on the one side that contains your carbonated meat, but it also connects to the regulator you had connected to the keg to fill it with gas.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is you put this little gun into your bottle, the bottle that is ready to be filled with a carbonated liquid. You use the gas button to purge it from oxygen, and then the trigger will fill very slowly without agitating and dispersing
the minimal agitation,
the dissolved carbon dioxide
into
the bottle until it's basically full, and you very quickly cap it, and you've got carbonated beverage in a bottle, sealed.
Okay.
There are other ways
to do that. Charlie.
Yeah. There are other ways to do it where, like, they have a, like, a number two bung you would put an airlock into, except they have both a gas port and a liquid port. So you push the bung into the lid of the bottle. You pressurize the bottle to whatever serving pressure you've got it at, like 5 or 7%. That way, when you press the liquid to pour it out, the pressure differential doesn't cause a big foam up.
Okay.
Just different ways to skin that cat, essentially.
Okay. I'm a skills guy. Okay. Now, obviously, this is a lot of equipment and hassle oriented here.
Right.
When I did this, I had a carbonation tablets.
Right.
And each tablet was good for a 12-ounce bottle. How are they at a disadvantage to this?
So the biggest disadvantage to the carbonation tablet process is that, again, one, you have to start with a dry product. You have to basically end with a dry product. Otherwise, you're risking a bottle ball, right? Cool. With this one, you can stabilize and sweeten to whatever desired level you have, and then bottle a carbonated beverage with this product. It will stay carbonated and stable and what have you.
Regardless of the sweetness flavor.
Right, because you've already done the process that kind of divorced from the carbonation. You're not deriving your carbonation from the yeast action. You're deriving it from pressurized CO2 that you pumped into it.
Okay.
Right?
So, okay. I understand. Now, the other way as I understand it, now mind you, I've cursorily looked over the
sure thing. Sure.
Is you could actually put sugar in a yeast active solution. I think you touched on it just a little bit ago.
Mm-hmm.
And then cap it.
Yes. And here's the thing. Like, when we talk about the bottle conditioning, you don't have to just do that with sugar, per se.
You mentioned the Zizol or...
Xylitol. Yeah. Xylitol is a non-fermentable sugar. It's a sugar-like thing that is sweet to us. You can use any sugar source for your bottle conditioning. For example, you could use more honey.
Okay.
You could use... We talked about last time different ways to add fruit. You could take cherry juice and add that to something as a sugar source.
Okay, now, this sounds like something you have to control the amount very, very
right
tightly.
If you look online for priming sugar calculator, you can find a number of these that are, you know, say, hey, I want X volume of CO2 in Y volume of beer, and I want to do that by adding honey or juice or maple syrup. Whatever you want to, whatever like vector you want to take on that. And it will tell you, okay, to do that, you need, you know, 32 grams of maple syrup, for example.
Okay.
That way you're not overshooting it and getting bottle bombs. Like we were talking about, those are really dangerous.
Really freaking dangerous. And I cannot tell you, I have yet to meet a mead maker ever that has not had some experience with bottle bombs or geysers, at least. And it's a danger.
Yeah. The pincushion of an onion is the worst bottle bomb I've ever dealt with, bar none.
Yeah, and I hope you never see anything close to that ever again.
Right. I've never shattered a carboy.
But I've heard people who have.
Yeah. This is not something I want to, you know, I'm not pressing the edge of this and saying, okay, let's see if
let's
I
give
can
it a
make
try.
It
No.
Yeah. Let's live on the edge.
No, that's not. No. I'll be very comfortable back here on solid ground. Thank you.
Yeah. I'm a boring old man. Thank you. I don't want to live on the edge.
Old, right. Sure.
My degree.
You're calling the old man in the room. You're calling yourself an old man with an old man in the room. Come on now.
We'll fight about this.
No,
we can live outside.
You're younger and stronger. You'll probably win.
Shushy.
So, you know, so we have the three. We have these methods. I remember three: adding sugar to active yeast, pressure, and the tablets.
So the tablets are basically there's two. There's an active yeast eating a sugar and creating more CO2 that this time is sealed in a bottle, or there's pressing CO2 into something without yeast involved. Whether you're using, you know, priming sugar or tablet or honey or whatever, you're always, you know, feeding yeast more sugar to make CO2.
Okay, gotcha.
If mechanically you're just adding pressurized CO2 into it, that's another thing.
Okay.
Two ways to do this, from my perspective. The ins and outs and the fine details are kind of, yep. You know.
Cool. Yeah. So, okay, we got over that. Okay. So, if you as our listeners want to do the carbonated mead beverage thing, pick the area you want. This is not something I'm likely to go into myself, as much as I can enjoy a sparkling mead. I like having my things nice and stable in my living room.
It's a bit of a hassle. And, you know, when we're talking about carbonating things, there is a danger there. And I have done my fair share of beer making, so I am a little bit more familiar with the idea of just bottle conditioning a beer than Chris is by nature and experience level. It is not the danger level to me that it can seem like to somebody that has had an occasional bottle bomb, but not really played with carbonation very much. That said, by the same token, I have the equipment to do the kegging and carbonating in the keg and, you know, transferring that to bottles. And I'm going to do that either way.
And I'm not saying I won't do it, but at this current stage of my mead journey,
yeah,
I'm not ready for it.
It doesn't have to be something you have to explore. And that's fine. As you guys listening at home think about this, you may think, well, you know, it sounds like it might be nice on a rare occasion, but it's not really what I'm looking for. I tend to go for, you know, the 14 to 16% ABV meats that, frankly, even if you're doing mechanical stuff, are real hard to carbonate.
And there you go.
Yeah. So this is,
I think, the lowest one I've ever made so far is 13. So that carbonates are really not my future at this point.
So if you guys have tried the 8% that I have recommended a long while back, that's a good candidate for this.
This is like our second, third show.
Yeah. It's not perfect for this. It's still a little high ABV for something carbonated, but I think it's a good candidate. I think it's a nice candidate for a sparkling mead. And why would you want a sparkling mead? Well, it's springtime.
It's
getting into summer. And so it's nice to have something that's low ABV. It's refreshing. It's got a little fizz, a little bite to it.
And you still cut straight lines in your lawn when you're mowing the grass.
The lawnmower mead.
Yeah. But anyway, so thank you for your time today. Hope to see you really soon. Again, tell us what you want to talk about. We will talk next time. I'm thinking we're going to talk about additives in meats for stabilizers and such like that coming up soon.
Yeah, we need to go do the deep dive, not only for stabilization, but some of the nice things we can get, like, you know, the different tannin products and the little yeast boosters.
Those things like that.
Yeast additives and things like that.
So we need to go over those and how they work so you can kind of customize your own needs out there.
Right, and kind of do a deep dive as to what those are and how to approach using those, because, you know, do we put the Rouge Boost in it for primary, secondary, right before we bottle? There's a way to use it and a way not to, right?
Yeah, and do you want to re-yeast anything or re-nutrient anything?
Can you mine X yeast and Y yeast? And what to look for to be able to know? I mean,
there you go.
What is a kill factor?
Yeah. So, thanks for coming. Have a great day. Jeff, talk to you in the next show.
Chris, looking forward to it.